Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
I'd like to welcome everybody here today to the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance, our weekly podcast. We're so glad that you took the time to download us today and are listening. We have another wonderful expert from the field of sports medicine with us today. We are pleased to have Dr. Steve Roth with us from the University of Maryland. Welcome, Steve.
Thanks, Tim. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Yeah. Just for our audience to know, Dr. Roth is an associate professor in exercise physiology, aging, and genetics at the University of Maryland. He got his PhD from the University of Maryland, but he also did a federally funded postdoctoral research fellowship at the University of Pittsburgh in human genetics. And so today we're going to talk primarily to Steve about his expertise in genetics and exercise, and he's recently been writing and speaking quite a bit about using genetic parameters to select people for athletic performance. So, Steve, let's just start off by explaining what that means, all that long verbiage that I just used.
Well, Tim, I think the big thing is that for a long time we've recognized that certain people seem to be very gifted at certain sports.
Right.
And because sport is such an important part of our culture, trying to figure out who is going to excel at a certain sport has been something of interest for ages.
Yeah. So if we could figure out who was going to be Michael Jordan before they actually became Michael Jordan, we'd be doing good.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, I think for a long time you kind of look at kids and you think, wow, that kid is really tall, maybe good for basketball, maybe that kid is really fast. But now that we've learned more about the science, things have gotten more sophisticated, there's a chance to identify particular gene profiles in these kids that could give a hint about their future potential. And so that's really what the idea is, that there are companies out there now selling tests called sports gene tests or something similar to that. And parents and coaches or athletes themselves can be tested for these genes. And the idea is that you're somehow improving the predictability of this outcome.
Well, I think just before we get to the technicalities and what genes are looking at and so forth and whether this is even valid, I mean, this seems to be based on the assumption that athletic performance is based primarily on inherent ability. Would you agree with that or not?
Well, I would caution that we certainly have a sense that there are some genetic predispositions. Certain physical traits do lend themselves to excellence in certain sports. It's obviously going to be very sport specific.
Yeah.
You think of a gymnast versus a basketball player, and you recognize that there are people who are going to be physically gifted in one or another sport, but certainly not across all sports.
Yeah, sure. You see very few 7-foot gymnasts, don't you?
Yeah, if any, exactly. In that sense, we know that there are these physical traits that lend themselves to certain sports, and those physical traits are going to be influenced at least somewhat by genetic factors.
Mm.
You may not see it in a 7-year-old, though.
Right.
And so is there some way that I can look at that 7-year-old's DNA and be able to say, oh my gosh, you're very likely to have the wingspan of a 737 and be an excellent butterfly swimmer.
Right.
Or something like that. So that's where this predictability comes in. So getting back to your question, are genes important? Yes. Do they explain everything? No, not at all.
Hmm. Okay. So I think that's a great way to come back to what you were talking about before about some of these companies that sell these sports gene kits so people can see what kind of predisposition they have. Well, what are they testing anyway? Are they testing all the genes that you have or just some of them or what?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there are about 23,000 genes in the human genome.
Hmm.
way too many for us to wrap our minds around.
Yeah.
And over the last couple of decades that people have actually been studying genes and exercise and sport, only a small fraction of those have actually been studied with any depth.
Mm.
And the number that I would say is even studied with some depth is probably enough to count on your hands. So these companies are focusing mostly on a small number of genes that have been studied in a handful of papers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to make predictions based on these relatively small number of genes. So I guess for your audience, this field, even though it's been out there trying to identify genes for the last 10, 15, 20 years or so, it's still very early.
Mm-hmm.
And we really scientifically don't have a good handle on what genes do contribute to sport performance. And so these companies are taking what information is out there,
mm-hmm.
but whether that information is complete, I would say we don't know, and I would guess to say that we're not even close to being complete.
Well, surely these companies have some basis for what they're trying to market and sell. I mean, they just couldn't go out and slap some labels on something and say, hey, look, we're going to measure this gene. Let's take one that you and I know about something about, actinin 3 or 2, and, make some predictions about athletic performance. Or can they?
Well, I'm not a business person, so I have to put that caveat out there for your audience. So I don't know exactly how businesses make some of their decisions, but in my analysis of these companies, they have selected genes that in most cases have some scientific evidence. In some cases, the genes have very limited scientific evidence, and it's pretty questionable how some of these genes were selected. Certainly, there are a handful that have been more studied. You mentioned one, alpha-actinin 3, or it's called ACTN3 out in the scientific literature, and that one is getting the most press and the most coverage in these different sport gene tests. And, you know, I think there's some interesting evidence out there that it might contribute a little bit to someone's ability to excel in sprint or power-related activities.
Mm-hmm.
But again, if you take a look at the science, it's contributing a small amount, and there are some inconsistencies in the science which make it very challenging to justify from a scientific perspective that this gene could have that level of predictability.
Right. Well, and I guess the other thing that we need to mention at this point and continue to remind ourselves as well as the audience is that most of these gene studies are what we call correlational. They're really not causative. We don't know for sure that these genes cause anything, right? Most of the studies have just been shown that they're associated with some trait.
You're exactly right, Tim. We have a slew of indirect evidence in these human studies that have taken a look at elite athletes and seen whether or not more or less of them have a certain gene profile than another. And in almost every case, even when a gene has been hinted at as being important, you can always find exceptions and find somebody with the opposite genetic profile who happens to be a marathon runner when the prediction would be otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
The only way we could do those sorts of cause and effect studies would be to actually take the gene out of somebody or put the gene in, and nobody's doing those sorts of studies in sport performance.
Right. Not that we know of, anyway.
Not that we know of, and we certainly hope not.
Well, you know, the Tour de France is about to start in a couple of days, so who knows what those guys have tried, right?
That's right.
Well, you recently did a presentation on this topic at the American College of Sports Medicine meeting that was in Denver. And if I recall correctly, there was one gene in particular that's being associated with susceptibility to concussion. And you have made a great case for the fact that testing for this gene actually may be distressful for some individuals, as well as not being a very accurate indicator of concussion. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, this is a concern that I have. So this is a gene known as APOE, or APOE for short. It's a gene that has numerous different functions in the body, and it, over the years, has been associated with Alzheimer's disease risk. And this is a very solid connection, and in fact, there have been animal studies that have backed up the correlational studies that you mentioned earlier. So we have a really good sense that this particular gene, which has a few different variations in humans, does contribute to Alzheimer's disease. So if you have a certain variation, you have an elevated risk of Alzheimer's disease.
Mm-hmm.
And so, rightfully so, scientists have then hypothesized, well, if you have this, maybe you're going to be more susceptible to brain injury, maybe you'll be more susceptible to Alzheimer's disease if you have a concussion or something like that. But these studies are just getting started. Mm-hmm. The companies, at least some of them, are including APOE in their sport gene tests with the idea that you'll find out whether you're more susceptible to concussion. And the science really is not there yet.
Mm-hmm.
I think the companies are making a couple of leaps and then a couple of inaccuracies.
Mm.
APOE genotype doesn't seem to predict concussion.
Mm.
And if anything, it might have something to do with severity of concussion after you get it.
Mm-hmm.
But those studies haven't been done. My bigger concern is that the consumers of these tests are going to be getting this information about APOE and concussion. And even if the scientific evidence isn't strong for concussion risk or response to concussion, they're going to be getting information about their Alzheimer's disease risk, which could be really challenging psychologically for these folks to get this information,
mm-hmm.
because it's going to be independent of their physician.
Mm.
Sport gene tests are sold basically over-the-counter, direct to the consumer. You don't need an insurance card or a primary care physician.
Okay.
You just surf on over to the internet site, and you can purchase these kits online. And so you'll be finding out your APOE status, and whether the company's not going to tell you this, but really quickly online, you can find out whether you're going to be at elevated risk for Alzheimer's disease or not.
Mm, wow.
And what are the consequences of that? I think they could be pretty significant for some people.
Right. Yeah, what if you take a high schooler and say, hey, you've got an increased risk for Alzheimer's later in life?
That's right.
Yeah.
And right now there's no treatment. You know, there's no cure for Alzheimer's disease, and there's very little that can be done to even slow the disease at this point.
Right.
So that's a heavy weight to bear for a lot of people.
Right. Comes back to, do you really want to know that kind of information or not?
That's right. And ultimately, all of the genes that are being tested have the potential to influence some other trait.
Hmm.
So even though they're being marketed in the context of sport performance, it doesn't mean that these genes couldn't also have relevance in other areas.
Right, right.
And the internet is an easy way to get lots of information,
mm-hmm.
But not necessarily complete information.
Mm-hmm.
And so people can be getting all sorts of information about these genes that could impact their health in other ways. And they're just not going to get the counseling that I think is going to be valuable for them, as if they were getting it through a physician.
Yeah. You know, a couple of thoughts strike me here, I guess, to backtrack a little bit. Are we talking about a lot of companies that do this right now? Are there just three or four of them out there?
Well, there are only about three or four of them pursuing sport gene tests that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But this idea of direct-to-consumer genetic testing is really exploding.
Mm.
There are lots of companies selling tests for what is known as nutrigenomics or nutritional genomics, for giving diet recommendations. And there are companies that are selling whole genomes, so thousands of different genes, genetic profiles for various health and ancestry-related traits.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we're really at the cusp of an emerging trend, and that there are lots of companies emerging that will start marketing these tests.
Now, from what I'm hearing you say, though, when we talk about prediction of sports performance, there may not be much basis to trust the results that you would get from those kind of tests.
I don't think that the science backs up any gene at this point with a high level of confidence that it's going to contribute to sport performance. There are some genes that you could make an argument for, but usually the context is very narrow, that you know, it's going to be a certain kind of sport or a certain kind of activity. And all of the marketing that I've seen from these companies, they're marketing far more broadly than the science supports, even if you take a narrow view of the science.
I guess looping back a little bit to the beginning, well, let's make a big assumption. Let's assume that in 10 years, the information will be available, and we've got, say, a list of 10 genes that predict something like, say, exercise endurance, how long we can run before we get tired. Would it Even knowing that there maybe is some validated genes that we can look at, would that be helpful in identifying who can do different kinds of sports?
That's a really tough question. I think ultimately genes are going to be contributing some fraction of the total of sport performance.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on any given day, you've got diet, you've got weather, you've got all sorts of other factors that might affect someone's performance on the field. So genes are going to contribute to some part of that. For some people, being able to predict is going to be lucrative, it's going to be beneficial in some way in terms of reputation, etc. And so if we did have 10 years from now, some profile that would predict maybe with 10% greater accuracy than the current talent identification programs, then I suppose that some people will find benefit to that.
Right.
I guess the question for me is just, what are the possible negative consequences?
Mm-hmm.
And you always have the chance that somebody's going to get rejected based on a genetic profile, and they would have gone on to have considerable success, even with that improper genetic profile.
Right. And actually, that was a question that Justin had given me about that, and about that deselection, almost, of people who may be actually, in the end, would be appropriate for that performance. But if they were deselected based on some negative types of genetic parameters, that would be a real tragedy.
That's exactly right. There's a published case of a Spanish long jumper who was excellent, won world championships, participated in a handful of Olympic Games, I mean, clearly an elite-level long jumper. And his ACTN3 genotype is exactly opposite of what you would predict of a sprinter or a long jumper. So for some of these gene tests, if he were to take that test, or his coach or something like that would have had him undergo these testing, he would have been pushed away from that sort of sport.
Mm-hmm.
What you think through the harm of that would have been tremendous.
Right. Well, let's see, there was a popular movie, Gattaca, I think came out 10 or 12 years ago. That was the one of the primary underlying messages is that in that movie was that in this future world, people were selected to do what they did in life based on their genetic code.
That's right. Yeah. And so you can envision a real slippery slope of ethical problems once we start selecting people based solely on their DNA sequence rather than their interests and motivation and personal desires and so forth.
Right. Now, there is some, I guess, protections put in place by the government that requires that we can't be discriminated or deselected from programs based on our genes. Isn't that correct?
That's true. There's a legislation passed I think it's about 3 years ago now, known as GINA, Genetic Information Non-Discrimination Act.
Mm-hmm.
And that does provide certain basic protections from employment discrimination and access to insurance, but it's not fully comprehensive. It only covers companies above a certain size. It doesn't cover certain types of insurance like long-term care insurance or life insurance. So there are some loopholes and some limitations to what that legislation protects.
So if I decided to go out for the track team and they did a test on me and they said, well, you don't have the genes for exercise endurance, so you can't be on the track team, that wouldn't be covered under that.
Well, for you, Tim, probably not.
I used up all my eligibility 30 years ago, so I probably wouldn't be eligible anyway.
That's exactly right. But in general, professional athletes are probably covered because for them this is employment.
Oh, that's true.
But
yeah,
for collegiate athletes or high school athletes, certainly this is not considered employment. And so there, these genetic testing information could be used in a way that arguably could be discriminatory, but it would fall outside of the realms of employment or insurance. And I'm not sure how that would fly against this GINA legislation.
Right. Is there any age at which this genetic testing, if we were going to do it, would be done? Do we wait till kids are 13, or do we do it earlier? Or?
Well, it can be done any time.
Okay.
You know, a DNA sample can be taken from just a cotton swab rubbed inside the cheek, so you can envision that from day one in very young kids. And certainly some of these companies have purposely marketed to younger kids. Now, they're not marketing to young kids. They're marketing to the parents of these kids.
Right. And to the dreams the parents have for athletic prowess, I guess, huh?
You got it. Exactly. And that's really the concern, is what decisions can the kids make? And
right,
what control do the kids have over their choices based on this information? Do they understand the consequences of the outcome of this testing? Are they going to get pushed into or out of a sport? There's just the chance for coercion. There's the chance for a lack of consent. And I'm afraid that parents and coaches generally are not going to have the background to understand the scientific limitations behind these tests.
Right. But is that any different than what it is now? I mean, there are many, many stories about parents pushing their kids into one sport or the other because for a variety of reasons. Coaches maybe pushing kids into a specific sport for a variety of reasons. Is this just another reason to do that, and so therefore it really doesn't fall outside the norm of what we've seen socially in the past?
I think you're right, actually. I don't think that it really does change this idea that certain parents or certain coaches are going to be a little over the top with trying to predict the future success of their kids.
Yeah.
Or trying to push them in certain directions that they think they will find success. But it does add a tool that I think is unique, and that this tool has far more questions about its validity and far more negative consequences than the more typical talent selection processes that are currently in place.
Right. So what does work? You know, what does work in talent selection? I'm a parent, I've got a 5-year-old kid, and I want him to be successful at whatever he does. So how do I figure out maybe what sport to help encourage him to play?
No, I'm certainly no expert in this, but in the reading that I've done and in researching this, there are a couple of different things. First is that the kid has to have an interest and an excitement about whatever sport he or she is pursuing. The other is that there's evidence to suggest that kids who participate in lots of different sports end up performing better in whatever sport they select later in life than those who are targeted very early for single sport participation. So encouraging your kids at an early age to participate in lots of different sports, and then letting them pursue those where they find success but also find enjoyment is probably the best predictor.
Mm-hmm.
And then within that, then you can start to get into more specific tests that are going to be sport-specific that might be able to better predict future abilities.
Hmm. Very interesting. I think you and I have a mutual colleague named Carl Foster, who's up at Wisconsin, and he's been attributed to saying the best way to predict how talented athletically your kid is going to be is take them to the park with a stopwatch, right?
Exactly, yeah. It really does come down to the actual performance. And if you think to these people who are out there with the stopwatches, you measure somebody any particular day, and they could have an off day, they could have a great day.
Mm-hmm.
And so for people who are out there trying to do this talent selection, you can appreciate their interest in having more tools.
Right.
Because it's more art than science. It's an inexact process. And so certainly they're going to sit back and say, hey, maybe this gene test will add something. And maybe someday it will, but I think right now the odds are very small that they're going to add anything.
Right. Well, that sounds like it's a great place for us to wrap it up for the day, because we're running out of time. We give our guests a chance to give us all a take-home message. So, Steve, you have a take-home message for us today?
Yeah, the take-home message would be that these companies are going to be marketing information that I think has very limited upside potential and considerable downside potential.
Mm.
So I think that there are more negative consequences that can come out of these tests than positive. So I would caution parents and coaches and athletes themselves that these tests might be fun to do, but don't take them too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly don't make decisions for your kids based solely on these tests.
Right. And I would add, if anybody wants just to give the $250 away that would normally cost you to do those tests, you can give it to the Huffines Institute, and we'll give you better information.
I completely support that.
Well, Steve, thank you so much today for taking the time to be with us.
I appreciate the opportunity, Tim. This was great.
Sure. And we'll have you back, and I don't know, who knows when we have some more positive information about genetic testing.
That sounds great. I look forward to it.
And for those of you listening, we haven't forgot about our free T-shirt question. Justin, you have a question?
Instead of calling them causal studies, what is the term to describe these genetic studies on sports performance?
Well, that's a good question. Be the first one to email us at huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu with the correct answer, and you'll get one of those nifty Huffines Podcast T-shirts. Again, do it quick, because we're running out of those shirts, and we know everybody wants a complete collection. And as we do these over the years, we're going to have different shirts every year. And so, again, thank you for taking the time to download us and joining us today. Join us next week for another scintillating conversation with another leader in the field of sports medicine. And until then, we hope you stay active and stay healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Justin Dobson and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by John Miles Productions at johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.